Tonight, we've got Ryan joining us from Proofpoint, and he is the Senior Vice President of Cybersecurity Strategy. Ryan, it's nice to have you here. Thanks for joining us tonight.
It's great to be here.
Ryan, could you kind of tell us a little bit about Proofpoint just out the gate so that we, so the viewers who are not familiar with your company can just kind of have a bit of a back story as to what it is that you do?
Yeah, sure. So we're a publicly listed cybersecurity company. We focus on protecting the way people work, which is absolutely under assault these days, mostly via threats transmitted via email, social media, and as we're going to talk about tonight, mobile apps.
Very good, thanks. Now, you perform threat summaries and analyses over the course of any given year, and your quarter three summary just came out, I believe, just a couple of days ago, if I'm not mistaken. So could you tell us a little bit about what you've seen as far as the trends go in kind of the malware, you know, how things have transitioned? I've seen a lot of transition over to mobile, and that's a big concern. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you've found in your current summary before we kind of really get into things tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see a very broad swath of data. We see the email traffic for about just north of 50% of the Fortune 100, some of the largest organizations in the world that operate in some of the most sensitive sectors. So quite a lot of the world's threats hit them in some way, shape, or form. And if you looked at the threat landscape in Q3, it was basically a magnified version of what we saw in the 3 months prior to that. You had ransomware absolutely out of control on the email vector. One particular ransomware family, in fact, known as Locky for the file extension it creates, was responsible for about 97% of the billions and billions of malicious messages that we saw in Q3.
Are we talking like an evolution of, say, the CryptoLocker-style ransomware here on PCs, or are we looking at, has this evolved to other platforms as well?
It is mostly still PC-specific. The CryptoLocker, CryptXX, there are actually dozens of families of ransomware.
Yeah.
It's actually up about 53% in the last quarter alone. And they're all, of course, related in that they try and do similar things. There are actually kind of more interesting versions of ransomware emerging that do slightly different things. I would point out one of my personal, I wouldn't say favorites, but ones of interest that's called Petya, P-E-T-Y-A. That actually does what the malware in the Sony attack famously did.
Really?
It overwrites the master boot record of the computer, rendering it unusable at the time it's actually rebooted. So ransomware is continuing to evolve, not just on PCs, but it's been extending to other platforms as well.
Wow.
There is ransomware that now exists in the wild for Android devices. There were occasional flurries of little Mac flare-ups that didn't tend to be very common. There was actually even a ransomware variant for Linux that didn't last very long before someone actually figured out what their key generation algorithm was and a very good way to actually decrypt the files without paying the Bitcoin ransom.
Just for those viewers who are here tonight and are not familiar with terms, the terminology that we may be using, ransomware is a fairly frightening type of malware because it can cause data loss, data theft, people being able to compromise your files. And that's where things get very scary because you may have pictures of your kids or you may have company emails. Mm-hmm. You may have very important business data, customer information, and things like that. And the reason that this type of malware is called ransomware is essentially it holds your files ransom and then usually gives a prompt or something along those lines that says, hey, you need to call this number, you need to do this or that, and transfer money or provide a credit card information. They're holding your files ransom, and that's a very scary thing. So we're starting to see this on the Android platform, you say?
We are. And the malware landscape for mobile devices is one that's very much emerging. You see mobile malware basically a few years behind the evolution of the same sorts of threats that affect PCs.
Okay.
But they're, of course, extremely related in what they're trying to do and also how they represent themselves. If you think about the typical ransomware that a person would receive on a PC, it's probably actually going to arrive in an email. It'll be attached as a file that looks like a very legitimate business document, maybe a financial statement or an invoice that has some urgency to it.
Right?
This is past due. Please open this up and pay it. Something along those lines. The sort of thing that most of us would absolutely open. And then it would, of course, if you clicked on the little yellow bar at the top, actually start encrypting your files. On the mobile side, it's a little different in that the ransomware has to exist in the form of an app. That's really the only way that sort of thing can be installed on most mobile devices, the way that the system architecture, operating system architecture, effectively works. So what that means for the end user is you're probably going to receive mobile amounts ransomware via a link. Again, that could come to you via an email. It actually could come via an SMS as well. And if you go to that link and install an app, most of the time it's not going to come from Google Play or an otherwise sanctioned app store. That app can do whatever you entrust it to do on your device. And most people, when they install something, just tap OK, I want to use this app. And that's very much how ransomware tends to evolve on the mobile platforms.
Can I throw a scenario at you, Ryan, that my wife actually encountered just this past week?
Sure.
Just because what we've seen on PCs and now we are starting to see on mobile as well, and you've likely seen it a lot longer time than I have because of the industry that you're in. Sure. My wife was apparently, this is the story anyway, so you can tell me if she, this is the lie detector test here. So she was looking at news sites and reading blogs and things like that, and all of a sudden her phone, this is an Android device, said, your phone is infected. Now that to me strikes me as possibly infected advertising. But what was different about this is she quickly exited out because she knows to, you know, get out of anything that looks like it may be suspicious, but then handed her phone to me in order to just make sure that everything's okay. And sure enough, on her dashboard was a root tool for rooting the phone, and something that is commonly used by hackers as well as legitimate users to root a phone so that they have full access to the root file system. So how is it that something like that could get into her phone just surfing the web?
So that is, I think your instincts were correct there. That is what we would call malvertising. Right, so a fully legitimate site that engages with a third-party provider to fill the advertising space on that site, which is equally true in a traditional web browser on a PC and in a mobile web browser on a mobile device, you know, that they will serve up ads that very often are malicious and point to things that either automatically invoke a download or invoke a download in such a way that then the screen is immediately obscured. There's actually a strange sort of cousin to this, which even exists on iOS, which we often refer to as scareware, where if you've browsed to the wrong site, and you could get there any number of ways, including by an advertising link from a fully legitimate site.
Right.
If you browse to the wrong site, it fills the screen, and it basically enters into what is effectively, and anyone who's ever taken a computer science course will know about this mistake, what's called an infinite loop. Right. So if you write a software program, usually incorrectly, it will essentially go around in circles if you make a certain type of coding mistake. In this case, the attackers are actually intentionally making that mistake so that the phone effectively goes around in circles while the web browser is running what is actually JavaScript code for those who are technically interested.
Right.
It will then basically freeze the screen, display a message, a usually fairly threatening message, like the one I'm sure your wife saw, and that will tell you to either call a number or visit a website and pay some Bitcoin to unlock the phone. But what it really is just a broken piece of JavaScript on a website.
Wow.
But from the user's perspective, the phone becomes unusable because all the classic techniques don't work. You can't tap it and it won't do anything. More technically sophisticated users will probably immediately be thinking, but why don't you do a hard reset? That's actually the answer. You push both buttons on the phone for iOS and different combinations for Android and just reset the phone. Everything will be fine.
Right.
But actually, we saw fraudsters making quite a lot of money with this scam, even on iOS devices.
So is it quite often strictly a trick? Is it a social engineering trick to try to get you to follow the directions, or is it actually infected the system?
Most of the time, it is a trick. And that follows a general pattern in cybercrime. There is a huge shift towards social engineering, away from sophisticated technical exploits. This doesn't always get accurately captured in the media, where there is still quite a lot of focus on things like, I would call out the Pegasus attack from a couple of months ago, which was a state-sponsored attack on a couple of journalists that actually involved three different iOS zero-days chained together. That's not the likely thing everyone is going to encounter.
Right.
It is much more likely that you'll run into this sort of scareware that's designed to get a little money out of you.
Okay. So why would you say this type of attack is on the rise? You alluded to the fact that some of these malware creators are making money off of this, off of tricking users. Obviously, that's the case. What is the driving force behind behind malware rising on the mobile platform?
It's simple economics. I think at this point, malware authors are basically businessmen in most ways. And their businesses look like SaaS businesses. Mm. They will invest their resources where the greatest return is. And as people move away from traditional computing platforms like PCs and onto mobile devices, more sensitive data goes there too. People care more about the information that's stored there than they might care about the information on their own PC. So it's a very logical place for the malware authors to try and move to, even though actually most mobile operating systems, Android included, are a lot more secure than most historical PC operating systems, right, simply because they were constructed at a later date when more things were known about what good security practice looked like on an operating system.
So when it comes to these, you know, increased attacks, is there a specific group that's being targeted? Like, are they primarily trying to hit like elderly people who are just getting onto these phones now, have no clue what they're doing? Or is there a targeted group that are they're looking to get, or is it just a blanket and see who's out there?
I mean, mobile malware at this point is very difficult to target. So it is sort of spray and pray from the attacker's perspectives. They're looking to put malicious links in very cheap ways on lots of sites where they're likely to encounter the sort of unsophisticated users you're talking about. On the PC side of things, ransomware for PCs is often highly targeted at organizations that are going to have sort of things like file shares, which we saw variants like CryptXX go after. Those are the shared servers where a lot of different people put their files that are that tend to be very valuable to, say, a hospital or a school district or a corporation. And that type of malware is very, very targeted at a different organization that's likely to have a lot of money because they care, or a lot of money that they'll pay to unlock those files because they care a lot about the value of those files. On the mobile side, it's much harder to do that same sort of targeting that is fairly easy to do based on something like an email address.
Sure, I would expect that the PC end of things, based on what you're saying there, would be probably grander scale as well. Because if I were to, you know, if I was a hacker attacking a company, if I could get into one system that could go out on the network and encrypt all of the files on network shares, usually there's a shared server somewhere that's got a Samba share that, you know, the whole company uses, then all of a sudden you're in big trouble.
Right. And you actually have now seen ransomware go after that first. So it won't encrypt the local PC.
Right. Look for that network share first. Yeah.
And very often it might even look for the backups to that network share first before it starts actually encrypting the primary, which is extremely clever and extremely evil when you think about it.
Yeah.
It's funny. Now, you mentioned, you know, trying to go after things like maybe education settings. And immediately my thought goes to the fact that, you know, with my kids' school, they don't send home, or they're trying to move away from sending home
paper
notes, mm-hmm. and it's the kids have computers with emails, and they're emailing parents, and I'm thinking, man, if they can infect a school and then hit all the parents, you know, by sending some link through an email, I mean, you could do some serious damage.
So, and they absolutely have. If you think about how much you would personally pay for the files that are either on your mobile device or on your PC, if they were locked up by somebody and you didn't have them somewhere else, it's usually a big number.
Sure.
And that's why the ransomware actually is a reasonably quantifiable security problem, which actually sits in contrast to a lot of others. And it's because of one of the fundamental pieces of technology that's enabled this to grow and scale, which is Bitcoin. Right, so we know what Bitcoin wallets are associated with these ransomware campaign attackers, and we can look, because it's public ledger, like how much money they're making off of all this, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
So we're talking about anonymous currency here being used in an untrackable way. To put things into perspective, because you think, you know, well, I wouldn't pay for my files and things, but let's say, you know, look at your phone. Pull out your phone and take a look now. Here we are in 2016. My phone is chock full of photos of my kids that mean a lot. People take their phones to weddings and special events. They take a bunch of pictures, and they're not always prompt to back up those files mm-hmm. and transfer them, which means having at least two copies and one copy that is completely air-gapped from the network. So we're talking an external hard drive stored in a drawer somewhere or something like that.
Yes.
But to put it into perspective here, so if I had a hard drive with all of my data on it that was really important to me, and this happens, okay, so here's a scenario. You've got a hard drive that has all of the files that are your kids' photos and all of these other things that mean a lot to you. To look at it from a consumer standpoint, because your phone is generally your personal files, and that hard drive crashes. Will I go to data recovery and say, okay, I need these files. These are important to me. How much is it going to cost to get these files back? And this is a legitimate, my hard drive has crashed. I need these files back. And sometimes a data recovery can cost thousands of dollars in a worst case scenario. So when someone takes over my phone and says, for £300 or, you know, $600, you're going to get your files back, the temptation may be there to say, okay, yeah, I'm going to do that because these are important to me. It's my data recovery. It's the way to get these files back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How dangerous is it for us, Ryan, to actually pursue that and hit that button that says, okay, I'm going to buy my files back?
I think that there are really two concerns that pop up there. And the first one, I would actually say, is an ethics concern. The people behind cybercrime are very bad people. Cybercrime has been used to fund real-world terrorism as well as cyberterrorism. And giving money to bad people is not something anyone should do lightly. So what's best is, of course, to have that air-gapped copy of all of the data that you cared about that doesn't actually run the risk of being encrypted by ransomware. But the second concern is one of simple logistics. Very often, these ransomware variants will have a very short fuse, and they will count down, and they will often destroy your files along the way as they count down.
Oh.
And oftentimes, you don't have more than 24 hours. So one of the really, I find this almost a disturbing practice, but it's sort of the reality we live in. One of the practices that's starting to happen at larger companies is they will actually go out and buy some Bitcoin in advance because it's not the sort of thing that you can get from the bank down the street, just in case they need it for ransomware scenarios, because this has become absolutely endemic. They wouldn't be sending billions of emails if it didn't work, because they have to pay some botnet operator.
You know, that is a sad fact.
Absolutely.
To be sure. We're speaking with Ryan Callenber from Proofpoint, and he is the Senior Vice President of Cybersecurity Strategy there at proofpoint.com. We need to ask it, and I hate to do this kind of a question, but Android versus iOS. We're talking about mobile tonight. Where are we safest between these two platforms?
If you are talking about the average user, you're safest on iOS, simply because...
Well, that's all the time that we have for tonight, so not what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, I know. If you look at the basic facts that go into evaluating the threats that you will very likely encounter on an Android device versus an iOS device, you really have no more than three major considerations. One is how easy it is to update and patch that device as vulnerabilities are exposed. And here, this is not actually Android's fault. It's not anything that Google can control. But when you're on the carrier variants of Android and you don't get updates the same way you do for iOS, which is much more controllable in that sense, your windows of exposure for these broad-based types of attacks, like stage fright most notably, are longer. And that is something that impacts the average user, especially when some of those attacks can be spread by simple SMS and not anything that can be controllable by the user.
Right.
The second piece of mobile risk that I think is relevant here is the apps themselves. It is very, very difficult, although possible, to find your way to a rogue app store for iOS. It actually, in most cases, involves doing one of two things. either jailbreaking the device, which is complicated, and most users don't even have this technical sophistication to do. I wouldn't recommend it unless you are an expert and you're very attuned to the security settings that you're comfortable with. Or actually, the second way that you can often get an app that has not gone through any security review onto your device is to find your way to any one of the many, many rogue app stores out there. We monitor about 150 of them, actually, that do something that's kind of interesting. So if you are a company, say I'm Acme Inc., and I have an Acme app for my own employees, but I don't want to put this in the public app store, I can go out to Apple and pay a few hundred dollars, I believe it is, for what is called an enterprise signing certificate. And then I can write my own apps using Xcode the same way you develop normal iOS apps. I can sign them using my own certificate, and then I can provision them using what's called an enterprise app store. So this Acme app gets onto all my users' devices, and it never gets to the public app store. That actually has a lot of legitimate business purposes that you can imagine.
Sure it does, yeah.
But cyber criminals have realized that, oh, wait, what if I steal one of those enterprise signing apps and then come up with counterfeit versions of all those very popular apps that everybody likes to pay a lot of money for? I can set up one amazing counterfeit app store, basically a Napster for apps, for iOS, because there's actually no technical limit to how many apps you can sign with one enterprise signing cert.
Ouch.
So now we are actually seeing, we saw this actually for the first time at a very large healthcare company. One of their users had an interesting app on his or her phone. I don't want to give anyone's identity away.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But it was a Lego Star Wars app.
Okay.
And that's not unusual at all.
Yeah, I have that on my phone for the kids.
Exactly. But this Lego Star Wars app didn't exist in any app store, and it was on an iOS device that wasn't jailbroken. So the question was, where did it come from? And we eventually traced it back to a very large counterfeit app store in China called VShare. It's still running if you want to go check it out at vshare.com, where you can find free versions of every popular paid app in both the Google Play and Apple App Stores. And they're just absolutely identical, except for the fact that there's probably malware in a good percentage of them.
So that whole recommendation just there, we'll retract that. Don't go there. Don't install them.
Yes. Yeah. So, I would just kind of qualify it in that the same thing is available on the Google site as well. It's actually easier to trust another app store in the way the Android operating system is set up. If you go to settings, you can actually trust app stores.
Right. Turn on like developer mode.
Precisely. Yeah. You're not even actually having to find your way to one of these crazy off-brand app stores that are actually very good at things like SEO. So a Google search for the free Lego Star Wars app will likely guide you there, but are not the sort of thing that the normal user who stays within the bounds of the app store is ever going to encounter. And the interesting thing about those apps is because they've never been reviewed by Apple or Google, they could be doing anything on the device. They could be a full-blown remote access Trojan because they could access any private API, and they've never gone through the traditional sorts of security checks. So actually, the average user who stays within the bounds of a typical app store will be fine on either platform, but lots of users really don't want to pay a few dollars for an app and find their way into a lot of trouble they probably weren't expecting.
You know, and not to bring up old news here, Ryan, but we see it's not just for software piracy to get a free app. We saw with Pokemon Go came out, and it wasn't available all around the world. So people were hearing about it, the news was talking about it, but people couldn't install it. So here in Canada, for example, people started going to these counterfeit app stores and installing it on their phone. And that's a good scenario, you know, a good example of, hey, it's more than just piracy.
Absolutely. And we found one Pokemon Go variant that had something called Droid Jack, which is basically surveillance software in the code for the Pokemon Go app. So
it's like super spy stuff here.
It is.
Yeah. Like if you ever watch Person of Interest and they, you know, Blue Gap or whatever, the phones and stuff, and start intercepting calls. And
right.
So with those kind of apps, like I know when the compromised Pokemon Go apps are coming out, I mean, you download the one from the App Store and there's, you know, oh, it wants to access your photos, your camera.
That's the other thing,
you know,
too, yeah.
Your phone. Right. But then you get the malicious one and it wants to access everything. So right. If you get an app that you download and you notice it wants to access everything, is that a good tip off that there's probably something wrong with the app? Or is that just possible that the programmers didn't really think too much and were like, oh, we need access to everything just in case? Like, is that a good indicator that there's something wrong with the app?
It is a good indicator that there is either something wrong with the app or that the developers don't pay enough attention to security and privacy concerns.
Right.
So it is something always to be cognizant of, that you are mostly going to be the one who subjects yourself to security risk on a mobile platform, simply because, you know, they're very, very secure operating systems by default, both Android and iOS. The apps, though, very often have legitimate reasons to access your data, and Android and iOS don't control what those apps do with your data. Right. So if you are actually trusting that app and that app developer to access some data on your device, like your photos, like your location, like your emails, like your SMS logs, you should think very hard about whether to accept that or not. And just tapping through and accepting the default settings is very often not a good idea. But certainly from a user perspective, we're all fairly impatient now, and it's not the sort of thing enough users pay enough attention to.
Right. So that begs the question, if you're, you know, you've done your, whatever it is you're doing, you've installed this app, is it just enough to delete the app to get rid of it? Like, how do you rid yourself to make sure that you're protected? And with that, what happens if you've done a backup? Like, say you do have one of those malicious apps on an iOS device, where when you do your backup, that backup is everything. If you do a restore, you get everything. Unlike with an Android, you can do your backup of your photos. Say you have to wipe your phone, you can throw your photos back on much easier. So how do you get rid of it? And when it comes to backups from your computer, could they still be infected? And are you just perpetually going in circles?
It is a good question, actually. So one of the examples that leaps to mind is I was recently working with the Chief Information Security Officer of an Ivy League-like university on the East Coast of the United States. He had an interesting problem with a professor. The professor just had somebody who was very clearly reading his email and downloading his files from a cloud file repository. And that person wasn't being terribly subtle about it. And it didn't matter how many times the professor changed his password, this was still happening. The security officer quite rightly assumed that, this is probably a keylogger on your laptop. You've got some sort of malware there. So he brought in the laptop, which was a normal Windows PC, scanned it with every tool he had, and it came back completely clean. So scrambling a bit, he then asked the professor, do you have any home PC that you use? I said, no, absolutely not. This is my only PC. It's a laptop. And then thinking quickly, the follow-up question was, all right, is there any other device where you enter your password? And the professor has said, sure, I have an iPhone. And so the security officer looks at the iPhone, completely normal, up to date, not jailbroken, no obvious signs of risk, but it had about 200 apps on it. So he asked him to take out the little USB to Lightning cable, plug it back in to iTunes, back up the phone, and then resync and uncheck the one box next to apps, which is something you can actually do. So he synced everything except the apps and then changed his password. And that worked. Huh. So one of those apps was just stealing his credentials over and over and over again. And that's the sort of thing that we are seeing happen more and more frequently as you trust apps with even email credentials. So like a third-party email client, for example, would be the type of app you trust with this. And that's actually compromising data in a much broader way than just even what's on the mobile device.
Scary stuff.
Wow.
Well, I appreciate your time so much, Ryan. I know we've been speaking for a little while about mobile malware and how that is impacting society and users in general. We all have a phone in our pocket. The final discussion that we need to have with you is what is there? You know, on my computer, I've got anti-malware. and I'm able to protect myself from computer viruses with anti-malware. On your phone, is it as simple as installing an application that will protect you from these kinds of things on both platforms, Android and iOS?
It's not quite that simple, unfortunately, because there's really actually two things that you would worry about. One is these sort of rogue apps that we've been talking about, which are often hard to identify. And many of them actually make it into the proper app stores. So what you really have to be vigilant about as a user is what those apps have access to in terms of your own data. Because they could be something that you wouldn't actually call malware, but they would be doing something that you would never think is okay with your data. So if they, if you had, for example, and this is a very common example, a business card scanner app that just uploaded a business card and turned it into a contact via what's called optical character recognition.
Sure.
So you don't have to enter it yourself. And it has access to your contacts, obviously, because it's uploading contacts. Very often, those apps will just sell your information as well as the information of everybody who is in your contacts to marketing firms.
Wow.
And that's the sort of thing that just is endemic and is hard to identify. And so really, it's a matter of understanding what apps you've given what permissions to and trying to be thoughtful about that. The second thing that is worth pointing out is Wi-Fi, right? So this, the same way that you can connect to a malicious Wi-Fi network with a PC, you can mitigate that risk slightly by using a VPN. You can very easily do that on with a wireless device as well, or a cellular device. And those Wi-Fi networks that you often find in airports that pop up, free Wi-Fi with a hash or something, so they show up alphabetically towards the top of the list of SSIDs, very, very likely to be fraudulent. And those very often do what you call man-in-the-middle attacks and can sniff things like passwords if you happen to enter them in a web browsing session while you're connected to that rogue Wi-Fi. There are a few apps in the App Store that can actually help you identify rogue Wi-Fi networks, and those are very, very good ideas from a security best practices standpoint for everyone, especially those of us who travel frequently.
So what you're saying is when I see that open network that says FBI surveillance van, I should connect to the Wi-Fi.
You know, it raises so many... so many frightening concerns, and you know, we're in this world where I look for open Wi-Fi and I want to use it, and I save on my data plan because it's free and available to me. So maybe we just got to watch for ones that we know and trust. We're speaking with Ryan from Proofpoint. He is the SVP of Cybersecurity Strategy. Ryan, where can we get more information, resources to help us stay safe on our mobile devices?
So at Proofpoint.com, we focus on mobile quite heavily in our threat research. You can find that at what we call our Threat Insight blog. We wrote about the Pokemon Go malware. We wrote about what we're seeing as a broader trend in Q3 in that quarterly threat report you mentioned earlier. And we also have quite a lot of best practices for everyone when they use mobile devices that are all up there on Proofpoint.com.
Very good. Ryan, thank you so much for your time tonight. All the best, and great speaking with you.
It was a pleasure. Take care.
Cheers. Thanks.